Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries, Odin's shield maidens, who decided who would live or die in battle. Robert Falcon Scott took two gramophones to Antarctica with him. He played this music, I discovered, on his way to the South Pole. And you can find Scott's set list, as it were, the 78 RPM shellac disc tracks he and his men listened to online. Scott died, of course. Ernest Shackleton was chosen to live when he should have died, you might have thought, in Antarctica or on his way back, he and his men. His is one of the great feats of endurance and courage. One of his contemporaries, Sir Raymond Priestley, an Antarctic explorer himself, said in a speech to the British Science Society many years later, "Scott for scientific method, Amundsen for speed and efficiency. But when disaster strikes and all hope is gone, get down on your knees and pray for Shackleton." So the New Zealand government once appointed Ernest Shackleton our Antarctic postmaster. It was hoped to have collectors buy stamps with King Edward VII land on them. Our next guest has written about both Scott and Amundsen, and her new book is Shackleton's Endurance, an Antarctic survival story. And Auckland's Joanna Grahovich joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Very well. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Feels good to have it out.
A minor survival story for you at the moment. You're still in managed isolation.
I am. I'm on day 4 of 14 days.
Oh, you've got a bit to go.
It's not a bad place to be if you're a writer. And I've just been in the UK. I've got a whole lot of new material for the new book. So it's lovely to have an opportunity to go through it at my leisure.
Oh, yeah, it would be. So this book, I'll ask you about your new book later, but this book, it's not a trilogy exactly, but it's the third in a set, as it were.
Yeah, it sort of turned out a bit that way. I started off by writing Into the White about Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition. And while I was writing that, I was sort of haunted by the ghost of Roald Amundsen. And I thought it only seems right that I should find out a bit more about him, because I do have to admit that while I was writing about Scott, I had this sort of maligned view of the Norwegians, and I didn't think that was right. So that then led on to a book about Roald Amundsen and the group of men that he led to the pole. And then after that, I decided that, maybe it was time to write about Ernest Shackleton. I'd always been inspired by Shackleton's story. That was probably the first thing that captured my imagination when I was a child, because my father had a book of Frank Hurley's photographs. But I did have this feeling that everything that needed to be written about Shackleton had been written. But a number of readers contacted me and said, could you write about endurance? And so I started finding out a bit more about it. And one of the things that really, I suppose, swayed me is that a lot of people know about Shackleton, but they don't necessarily know a great deal about the other men that accompanied him on the endurance expedition. And that, to me, is the real magic in the story, is uncovering the lives of the other men that were with him. Very capable men. Obviously, there was the tremendous skipper and navigator, Frank Worsley, who's a Kiwi. But there were also incredible individuals like Frank Wild, Tom Crean, who's just an icon in the world of polar exploration. But also there were the tricksters and the eccentrics, people like Thomas Ord Lees and Harry McNish, the carpenter. And I think it was quite important to bring them into the story as well. So even though the book is called Shackleton's Endurance, it takes material from all of their journals, all of their letters and subsequent archives. So that was what was really important to me. Yeah, it wasn't just his expedition, it was a team effort.
Yeah, you really flesh their lives and opinions out. I found this line, actually, Joanna, from a review of Shackleton's endurance on Bob's book blog, and I couldn't resist because Bob says, I can't for the life of me understand why Shackleton and his men were obsessed with the polar region. Freezing cold and an environment which makes it man versus nature, and you know nature is always going to win. And most of us have some sympathy, at least for Bob's point of view. So what fascinates you about Antarctica that has kept you coming back to the topic?
I think probably it's the fact that there is nothing there. And not only is there nothing there, but it's an incredibly hostile and unpredictable environment that really reduces everybody to their essence. So I think that's an interesting context for a writer who is interested in character and people's motivations. It does seem extraordinary that a place that is so hostile to human life could really get under the skin of so many people. Yeah. I mean, the fact that it got under my skin when I was a child, and it's something that I find again and again with other people who are involved in either research in polar regions or are interested in the historical angle, everybody just gets the fever. Yes. And it actually happened to Shackleton as well. You know, to begin with, he had no natural affinity for polar regions. He was a seaman in the Merchant Navy, and it wasn't until he really went down to Antarctica with Captain Scott during the Discovery Expedition that it really got into his, you know, under his skin. And he said as much that once you get the fever, you can't stop going. And in fact, that was, you know, the end of him, because he knew, I think, that ultimately it would, the wild would win.
Yeah, and it did. You're a vigorous sort of author. I mean, here you are online with Earl Spencer at his Althorp Literary Festival in Northamptonshire. Here you are at the Writers and Readers Festival in Auckland with a life-sized stuffed sled dog. You really get about. Tell us, can you just, I want to get on to, obviously, Shackleton, but can you just tell us how Roald Amundsen, who got to the South Pole first, lied to his crew?
I found that extraordinary. So essentially, Roald Amundsen was making a bid for the North Pole. He had all his preparations complete. He had a ship, the Fram, which in effect belonged to another great Norwegian explorer, Fridtjof Nansen. He had lent him the boat for the bid for the North Pole, and then he found out that Captain Peary had got to the North Pole before him, and so suddenly all of these preparations, and the thing about the polar expeditions is the preparation, the financing, getting everything in order, the staffing, all of these things take a very long time to pull together. So he was in effect left having done all of the preparations but had no object. So he decided that what he would do would be to race Captain Scott to the pole. Now, he did tell the Norwegian Parliament, as well as Nansen, who had lent him the boat, that what he intended to do was to head south, round the bottom of South America, up through the Bering Strait, and he was going to get the boat locked in the sea ice and complete the first drift across the pole, across the North Pole. That was what he told everybody. So when he started off from Norway and he headed south, really it was only the captain of the boat, Thorvald Nilsen, that knew that they were heading for the pole. Everybody else thought that they were going to do this polar drift, which would have, you know, been a voyage of reasonable significance, would have delivered on a number of geographical and also scientific objectives. But it was only when they got to Madeira, which was their last port of call, that he told the men aboard the boat, the Fram, that they weren't going to do this polar drift, that they were in fact going to go south to Antarctica, and they were going to race Captain Scott to the pole. And he gave the men the opportunity to leave the boat and go back to Norway. He said, I'll pay for your passage back to Norway if you decide that's what you want to do. But not one man turned him down. And what's interesting in reading the diaries of those men is that none of them were actually sure of you know, changing their mind. A lot of them only agreed to do it because nobody else had turned them down. So it was a case of, you know, but I wanted to, but nobody else did. So
yeah.
We've ended up going. So I think that was audacious.
He had that on his mind all the way down. It's quite remarkable. Okay, let's get to Shackleton. As you say, a story often told, but you tell it differently. He was Irish. His parents had sacrificed to have him appear English so he could get ahead in life. He was a man with a point to prove. Can I skim through the early details for people for whom those details are fuzzy? So in 1914, he's already an explorer, a noted explorer. He's a charismatic man. He doesn't have much money, but he wants to run a top-notch Antarctic expedition. So he raises the money, Joanna. How?
Well, that's an interesting question because one of the things with those early British Antarctic expeditions was you needed the backing of the Royal Geographical Society, and there was a bit of a tricky relationship there. Why that was necessary was because once you had the stamp of approval from them, you then could take that and go around sourcing finance from wealthy sponsors, as well as from, you know, get the patronage of the king as well. So I don't know how much detail you want on that, but it sort of springs from the fact that the Royal Geographical Society was really aligned with Captain Scott and his objectives. They had supported his discovery expedition, and Shackleton had played a key role in establishing the further south record during that time.
Sure.
He had accompanied Scott and Wilson to the pole. They'd got, well, partway to the pole, they'd got to 82 degrees south. But then Shackleton, he became almost critically unwell on the trip back from that sledging journey, and he had been sent home, which was a huge blow for him because the other men had stayed on. He was not the only one that was sent home, but the others were men that were unsuited for that Antarctic and to remain in that Antarctic environment.
Yes.
So already he was a bit of an outsider. The Royal Geographical Society then he approached them to finance or to at least support his Nimrod expedition, which was hoping to make another attempt on the pole. But in the interim, Scott had started to plan his Terra Nova expedition, and the Royal Geographical Society were 100% behind that.
Yeah.
So the funding was always going to be a problem without that official backing.
Yes, I was just intrigued because I knew that you explain in the book the force of his charisma and the chanciness of the whole funding coming together. And, I mean, that's part of the man, his powers of persuasion. That's what I was
interested in. And I think that's when his character really comes to the fore. You know, I'm going to talk about him in present tense. You know, he had this extravagant enthusiasm that was really contagious. He was an incredibly inspiring speaker. He was excellent at self-promotion. And that really stood him in good stead. I think that really overcame the challenges of being an outsider, of being an English, being an Irishman in an Englishman's world.
Yeah.
And also, I think that a lot of people found him a bit too much. A lot of people worried about his. It is the fact that he was sort of a bit bored by detail, and that in terms of planning, it wasn't necessarily watertight, this plan that he had to to go to the pole. But in the end, he proved them all wrong, because during Nimrod, he achieved great things. He and three other men made it to 88 degrees south. So that was another further south record. And during the Nimrod expedition, they were able to make the first ascent of Mount Erebus, and also Douglas Mawson, who was on that trip, and Edgeworth David, they had managed to locate the magnetic South Pole as well. So there were tremendous achievements associated with that. And then it became very difficult for the Royal Geographical Society to ignore him when he came back. And that, of course, was when he got knighted. So he became Sir Ernest Shackleton, which made it far easier to finance further exploration.
Let's get to the expedition where that you feature in the book. The backdrop to this is that it's 1914, on the very eve of war. And at one point, he offers his ship to the Admiralty. Now, why do they turn him down?
That's an interesting question. I think that the expedition was literally about to depart from Great Britain. And I think it was actually Churchill that gave the order to proceed. I think that it was just too problematic to stall something at that point. But that really hung over Shackleton. He did feel very guilty that not only was he taking a ship outside of the arena, but he was also taking a lot of young men who would have been deployed in the conflict. And that really started to bite once they lost the ship and they were sitting on the ice down in Antarctica, unable to do anything.
Yeah. But after they finally all returned, a number of them, including Shackleton, volunteered for the war because it hadn't finished by the time they got back, which is fascinating. Mm. So Frank Worsley's the captain of the Endurance. He's a New Zealander. You start to infuse the history with a novelist's imagination as well, although, you, as you say, you used lots of references. But at the port in Buenos Aires, where the last of the crew are hired, not everything's going swimmingly.
No, it's not. No, it really is an expedition that's been mounted with this, you know, on the smell of an oily rag. They didn't even have enough coal to reach Buenos Aires. It was only James Wordy, the chief scientist of the expedition, who was from a wealthy family. He managed to he lent Shackleton £25 so they could actually get some coal.
That's incredible.
To get going.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and it's really South... it's amazing. I mean, Shackleton really was the master of improvisation.
He was, wasn't he? South Georgia's the last port of call before Antarctica. You paint an unpleasant picture of what it was like, which starts with the smell. Can you pray see just quickly, so we can fit everything in, what happens to the Endurance?
While in South Georgia?
No, in the ice.
And okay. So already once they reach South Georgia, they hear that the ice conditions further south are unseasonally awkward. The whaling fleet that from South Georgia, the captains have said, you won't get down there, you've got to, you know, give it a bit more time. So they were waylaid already 1 month, which was of critical importance, because what they were attempting to do was to cross the Antarctic continent. Now, that was, their ability to get to the continent was already fatally compromised by this month-long wait in South Georgia. And so already they start seeing their timeline shift quite significantly, which requires a great deal of planning around, you know, what do we do with the boat? Do we keep the boat in the sea ice? Do we drop men and then leave them and then start the traverse a year later? So there were all of these questions that they were grappling with. Once they headed south from South Georgia, they had a reasonable time in the sea ice. They were caught out and drifted a fair bit, but ultimately they got there by January. January they had a bit of a clearing and were able to steam ahead. But then the boat got properly caught at the end of January, and it was never released again. In fact, they drifted for 9 months in the sea ice.
Yeah.
And the way that the Weddell Sea works, the currents work, they sort of go in a clockwise direction. So at least that was of some comfort, in that they were going to eventually be forced out northwards. But the thing about the sea ice is that it's not benign. It's a sort of a moving beast, and it's the boat was subject to enormous pressure, because essentially you have the entire Weddell Sea compressing around your boat. There's very, very little likelihood of the boat surviving.
And
it's a tortured zone of, you know, turrets and ridges, and the pressure is just extreme.
Oh, it's amazing to envisage it. So long story short, the boat sinks, as we all know, and early on, as they set off across the ice floes trying to get further north, the quartermaster, or whatever his title was, wants to ration the men to 1.5 small sausages each per day, because they only have 40 days' worth of food. But Shackleton says, no, 2 sausages. And he refuses to start stockpiling seal meat. And it's interesting why he does this, Joanna.
Well, it's purely to maintain the sort of morale of the men in those early stages, where he didn't have a plan. I mean, he was improvising. But what he knew with great certainty was that if the men were not convinced that there was a plan, then the group dynamic would start to disintegrate, and he would lose men. And I think, as we all know, food is one of those things that can really keep your morale up. You know, if you've got nothing to look forward to at the end of the day, things start looking very grim.
He was a great leader, essentially, in that respect. And he once said, "I have marvelled often at the thin line that divides success from failure, and the sudden turn that leads from apparently certain disaster to comparative safety." So he was outstanding, but he was lucky. I mean, the Valkyries did ride with him, seeing as I've been determined to incorporate the Valkyries in this interview. So he decides eventually to gamble on an epic small boat journey, and it is truly epic, isn't it? What he's facing, he and the men he takes with him, is enormous.
It is, but it was essentially their only hope. So after 9 months on the sea ice, they had 3 small boats, 3 tenders, and they initially tried to drag those boats across the sea ice to open water, but it was just too difficult. And so they had established a camp, which they called Patience Camp, unsurprisingly, and they drifted on the sea ice again. The sea ice was drifting north, and they felt that once they got far enough north, the sea ice would begin to break up and they would be able to launch these boats. But it was a very sketchy idea, because when the sea ice starts to break up, it doesn't sort of float away in a very very ordered way. It's a zone of huge, sort of a violent zone of ice and waves, and, you know, getting through that was their first challenge, you know, that this incredibly tumultuous, boiling, violent zone where the sea meets the ice. And once they got through that, they managed to launch these 3 small boats, and with a combination of rowing and sails, they made the journey to Elephant Island. They were actually hoping to reach an island called Paulet Island, where they knew there was a cache of supplies left by a previous expedition. But a combination of winds, foul winds, and tricky navigation meant that they lost the chance of getting there, and they were sort of being blown out towards the South Atlantic. And that would have been really unsettling, because there was always the possibility that they would actually overshoot all of those islands in the Antarctic Peninsula and head out into the into the South Atlantic, and of course that would have been a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, we're running out of time to talk about the entire enterprise, but it was, I mean, Elephant Island, miraculously they had a shingly beach where they could pull the boats up above the high tide mark. That might not have worked. The journey to South Georgia was beset with almost constant peril. They couldn't land because of a terrible hurricane, which sank a 500-ton steamer not far from them. And once on land, they had to get across South Georgia, and that was an epic journey in itself. So you retell the story, but you infuse it with, as you say, a lot of the personality of the men and a lot of the day-to-day trials. And that's the different approach you took in part, isn't it?
Yes, and because I work from the men's diaries, I get that's where I sort of mine all of the detail, and that's to me that brings the story alive. Those little daily details, the conversations too that they have reflect conversations that they had. Obviously, I'm recreating the dialogue, but you can sort of triangulate, because if you've got diary from, you know, three of the men that are, you know, explaining the same situation, the same episode, you know where everybody is coming from. So you can sort of recreate it with a fair amount of certainty. But the details themselves, I think they are, that's what I find really interesting about the story, the food and the fact that they, you know, they have to eat basically what they can, you know, it ends up being rather disgusting towards the end of the men who were left on Elephant Island were really digging up old sort of rotting corpse, you know, the rotting carcasses of seals that they'd, you know, previously abandoned.
It's an amazing survival story. Shackleton's Endurance, an Antarctic survival story, and we've been talking to Joanna Grahovic. Now, what are you writing about next, just before you go?
So I've swapped to the Arctic. I'm now doing an Arctic story about Franklin's, it's a story about Jane Franklin, who was the wife of Sir John Franklin, who went missing trying to navigate the Northwest Passage. So it's coming to it from a woman's point of view, which is something entirely different for me.
You're staying in the cold.
I don't think I can get away.
Well, certainly not for the next 10 days, because you're in managed isolation. Hey, lovely to talk to you. Well done on the
book. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
Joanna Grahovic.